All right, we're joined on the programme now by Brendan Devaney as we look forward to tonight's special DL debate. Brendan, to all intents and purposes, seems to be using a potato as a camera, but we shall, as long as we can hear him, that's all we'll worry about. Brendan, how are you getting on?
I need an upgrade, Greg.
Upgrade?
Once he's sponsor me a new laptop, I'll put it out.
Yeah, you get on to Brogan. Come here. It's another packed one. It's a special show. It's a special show tonight, isn't it? You're broadcasting live from Sister Sarah's Bar and Restaurant in Letterkenny, and you've got a great lineup of guests. It's great to bring the show out on the road, Brent.
Yeah, sure. And I suppose respect to the sponsors too. You know, Sister Sarah's is a brilliant bar and restaurant down there. I mean, it's a great setting to be in. And yeah, it's just something different. Greg, taking it out, there's always a different feel to it, you know. So if anybody wants to come along, come down to Sister Sarah's as ever, you know, you'll get the welcome of Sarah's, and you can watch and hear the show there and see the contributions of the panel. So looking forward to it, yeah.
Yeah, great panel. John Gilday, Brendan Kilcoyne, Barry Meehan, and Donegal News reporter Ryan Ferry too. So a great sporting chat against people who amongst people who know what they're talking about. It's live on the radio just after 7, but you can go down to Sister Sarah's and watch it live for Radio Hacks and or anoraks and what have you. That's interesting, and just general sports fans. Obviously, lots of local stuff to talk about. Quick word on the ladies' final yesterday. Dublin just proving too much for Kerry. Sharpshooters they are. They didn't waste many chances earlier on, and Kerry just couldn't claw them back.
Yeah, listen, the more the men, Greg, the Dublin ladies team in this last decade have just been, you know, they've been at the top of it every year. They're in the round of favourites to win it. And I think last year, you know, we beat them and they come back this year. And the game I seen in Balbuffet, you know, they just looked phenomenal. The speed of attack and the skills that they had all around the pitch. They thought that game was going to be close yesterday. They haven't seen the two teams in action. Greg, I had no doubt Dublin were going to win it. They're convincing winners, and they are setting the standard. So, yeah, a phenomenal time and for GAA now to represent Dublin. And I suppose everything that goes with it, Greg, you know, they've really homed the best of what a city can bring. You know, it used to be a thing that the GAA, the rural, had it over the town teams and the cities and all that, but that's all been flipped on its head now. It's the other way around now. The places of huge population have got all the benefits and the backup, and it seems that they're excelling. That's why Dublin, you know, ladies and men's are producing such serious footballers.
Yeah, and I'm sure Donegal and Donegal fans will look on at their performance and put it into context there. Locally, a big weekend for hurling. Satanta, another senior crown. St. Eunan's also, and it's good to see, I presume, as a St. Eunan's man, you know, the seniors of the senior champions of the future, potentially.
Yeah, and Karen Donovan, the intermediate. It was a big weekend, Greg, in hurling, and, you know, one of the big talking points after it was how long the Ulster campaign is going to be away, and it's 12 weeks away, and, you know, doesn't seem right at all. Like, you know, and as I talk to more people about it, you know, I thought, you know, like the seasons, they're trying to pull the seasons apart, and there was this lag. Like, I can't believe the amount of time frame, but talking to other people, the hurling championships aren't to where we're at in terms of the other counties and that. So how the likes of, you know, our teams going to Ulster for an Ulster campaign now is doesn't seem realistic. I mean, it's 12 weeks. I mean, you're in the middle of it. Look at Satanta, the season they had, they were unbelievable. I mean, unbeaten, you know, they were just the real powerhouse, as they have been of Donegal hurling this last number of years. So, you know, how are they going to get back to championship form in 12 weeks' time? They're literally, it's a different season, Greg. So that's difficult. But, I mean, they were deserving winners, you know, 11 points in it at the end. That's a bit tough on St. Eunan's because they hung in there. Greg, you know, goals really killed them, obviously 4-13 to 14 points. And indeed, you know, two goals in the first half, a penalty just at the end of the first half, and St. Eunan's kept clawing their way back. It was 2-8 to 11. And the game was getting feisty, Greg. You know, there was a few tackles get in. And at that point, if Eunan's had got a goal, it might have made for a very interesting second end of the match, the second half of the second half. But as it was, Santander went up the pitch and the corner forward, Murray Campbell, had two brilliant corner forward goals. And the contest was over. But listen, I suppose St. Eunan's won the junior. They'll be happy about that. They lost the final last year. and Karen Dunham won the intermediate. So we have up on the site there interviews from players and management and the whole lot of going.
What's the solution to that gap, that 12-week gap? Because as you're saying, I don't think it could have been put any better. It's effectively a new season. Yeah. So what is the solution to that? Why are we concluding the hurling so soon then in this county? And what are other counties across Ulster doing? Like, are all county champions facing into a 12-week gap? Pardon my ignorance on this, Brian. Best to answer the question straight out.
Yeah, I was only having the discussions, on Saturday, with people about this, about the break, and was it the same for everybody? And then I found out it wasn't. But the situation, there's a couple of things. We have a small amount of teams to work off. The championship is shorter. Also, the hurler guys would be saying you've got some dual teams, even though Satanta's are only hurling club only in the county. They obviously have some dual players as well. But a lot of other clubs have dual players. They think that our senior championship starts next week, starts on Friday. That's what we're previewing. They're saying they wanted the hurling kind of finished up before that. Is that an issue? How much of an issue is it? But certainly, Greg, I mean, anything over 3 weeks, really, if you're leading the Indian Ulster campaign, is too much. Mm. The fact that it's 12 is, as I say, it's another season. So how much that affects them or not, it's very unfair as well, I think, in terms of trying to do your own year. So what you have with the teams now going into Ulster is there's a certain level of training they have to do to keep ticking over. And that's not really sport, you know, and it's very unfair on them, Rick. So I think something has to be done around that. Now, I can't believe how far off the championship is. The Ulster Championship, surely, with the club season the way it's changed, should be pulled closer. So there's probably 2-3 parts to this story, Rick, but it's certainly not going to do our teams any good.
It can't be beyond us, too. It's scheduling. And listen, nothing's impossible. But as you say, you know, it's to make way, perhaps, for all these players to be available for their football teams. And there's going to be an extensive preview of the senior, intermediate and junior football championships here in Donegal. I suppose just start with the seniors. Do you see anyone going to break through this year or any dominance going to be broken? You're going to be talking about it all this evening. But, I mean, do you see anything there that's going to sort of shock us this year?
Yeah, it's been a while since there's been a shock, Greg. I think it's 2016 since a team that wasn't in the top four beat one of the top four, you know, that a team from outside had a victory. And listen, this is all going back to the nature of coached football and the way systems have kind of... It used to be back in the day, championship was on the day and you could always get a shock because a team come out with some mad spirit and Madachi and it was man for man and things would happen. Now, it's all about the system. It's playing the percentages. So the team that has the better players wins the game by and large, and that doesn't really change because it's so methodical. So listen, but there are teams on the up. I suppose Glen Swilly would be the most notable one, Division 2. You know, they've Michael Murphy out there fully tuned into them this season. They are a wee bit of a dark horse, I suppose. Listen, good things have been done with a number of other clubs. Now, you know, you think, obviously, McCool's, Glenfance, and Michael's sides together all, you know, putting the best foot forward. Rua are coming on well, and Greg, but yet you have certainly a hierarchy that's there. Now, that used to be a top four. It's probably not anymore. Greg, you know, you're saying St. Union's and Niamh Connell probably are a step ahead. Listen, what Kilcare come back with this year, Paddy? McBertie, of course, was injured most of the year. You know, if he comes back fresh and the likes of the McHughes and these boys, McLean's going to have a big push in the championship. Where Gidoa are at, they've lost quite a few players. But certainly the league final a few weeks ago, Greg, had our two best teams. It wasn't a great advert for football. Mm. Now, there were certain players missing in that, but as it stands, Unions are favourites for the championship. Niamh Connell very close and behind them. And then the other sides that I mentioned there, will that change? You would doubt it very much so, Greg. But from a neutral's perspective, it would be interesting. There's a change in the championship now, Greg, which may throw up a couple of earlier bouts of these bigger teams, which might change things a little and allow maybe one of the teams outside Lafour to maybe get to somewhere like a semi-final.
Is that good, though?
Yeah,
that just means potentially that the latter exciting stages of the competition become a little bit more predictable.
Yeah, well, there's no seeding, you see. It used to be seeding, Greg, so the top teams were playing the weakest teams, if you like, and that was why if you topped the group after your two home and two and away, you got the weakest team you could play. So that's been torn up this year. So what's going to happen is the top four teams go automatically into the quarterfinal. There's a preliminary then where 5th play 12th, 6th play 11th, and so on. So of the four teams that go through, then you've 8 teams, and then there's no seeding. So that's an open draw. So that'll be a very interesting draw, because you could have the likes of St. Junius playing Lee Connell in the quarterfinal. So you mightn't have this semi-final, final thing that we were getting the last few years.
Yeah.
And you could have some interesting pairings in there. And who knows in those games if teams can have a cut at other and liven up our championship.
Finally, one random one. I mean, are you hearing anything anecdotally about the impact of emigration on the sport? Because, you know, if you're on social media every day, there's young people leaving. I'm not sure they're involved in the sport or not, but is there any sense on the ground, as I say, Brent, even anecdotally, that, you know, we're maybe not at senior level, maybe more intermediate or junior football, that certain players aren't available because they're off to, I don't know, live their life somewhere else?
Yeah, it seems to have certain different clubs, different times. You know, you talk about the top teams. You know, there's 5 St. Eunice players in America this summer. They're all coming back. There was one Lee Connell. You know, outside of that, just because I'm down in Goodora a bit, they have lost quite a few players to immigration, teaching at different things. You know, it's such an attractive proposition. You know, they head to the Middle East or somewhere and do something to get. So again, what we started up at the start of the conversation, Greg, it seems to be sometimes the more, you know, rural areas away from the towns seem to get hit that bit more with immigration. But a lot of the top teams seem to have their same complement. I mean, we talk about Neve Connell. These guys just keep coming back and coming back. It's amazing that they have so many veterans in there.
Yeah.
You keep thinking maybe 3 or 4 years ago they're going to retire. They keep coming back. So, listen, they'll be formidable. But it seems to be all those top teams, Greg, Ghidorah certainly have lost a few players over the last number of years. They'd be the one that I would have noticed, yeah.
Right, OK. It's a special show tonight because, firstly, it's reflecting back on a busy weekend of hurling, but looking forward to the Senior, Intermediate and Junior Football Championships here in Donegal. A lot of people waiting with bated breath to see how that will all pan out. It's a big panel: John Gilday, Brendan Kilcoyne, Barry Meehan and Donegal News reporter Ryan Ferry. And it is all live, if you can get along, from Sister Sarah's Bar and Restaurant in Letterkenny. So you can see the show in person, see what goes on behind the scenes. Alternatively, of course, you can just listen as you always do after the 7 o'clock news, or podcast it then at a later time on highlandradio.com. So you can listen to the DL Debate in association with Sarah's Kitchen and Sister Sarah's Letterkenny. And thank you so much for joining us on the programme today. And we'll have a whip around and get you a camera to plug into that laptop.
Nice, Greg.
All Cheers. Right, take care of yourself. All right, bye-bye. Brendan Devaney there. Okay, our Monday Focus coming up for you after the break. And on Monday Focus today, we remember the victims of the Oma bomb, which happened on the 15th of August, 1998. 29 people died, hundreds were injured. The bombing by a distant Republican group, the Real IRA, was the largest single atrocity of the Troubles. No one's ever been convicted in connection with the attack. And we'll say good morning first to journalist Anton McCabe. Thank you for joining us, Anton. When reflecting on the Oma bomb, I struggle to put it into words or into context. It is so shocking, so horrendous, and reaped so much devastation and loss. It's really, as I say, I find it hard to even frame it, Anton.
Yes. It was the biggest single atrocity of the Troubles. But also, I think, for people, what was what really shocked was that it had seemed that the Troubles were over. It was 4 years after the first IRA ceasefire. It was after the it was 4 months after the Good Friday Agreement. It seems as if that was over. And then while Oma had been touched by the Troubles, it was not one of the towns worst affected. So that again, and also I think the big thing was that people's guard was down, and that it was. It was so absolutely horrible. Like there were, as well as the 29 dead, there were approximately 400 injured. But there was also the majority of the dead were women and girls. They were young people. They were a total cross-section of humanity. And then, like, there were the three young lads from Bontana, and then particularly a young woman and a boy from Spain, people who had never even have heard of OMA, let alone being an OMA, except for just a sort of pure bad luck on that day.
Mm. Anton, I mean, obviously you were you live close to the scene. You were one of the first journalists on it. And I could introduce you as a journalist who was on the scene. And that's, of course, 100% accurate. But, I mean, obviously there were people physically harmed, an awful loss of life and many injured. But you must feel the scars of that day as well. You're a victim also of the OMA bombing, though you escaped physical injury.
Oh, yes. Like, I can still smell, you know, I can still remember that smell of the explosive and of burnt human flesh. And that will never leave me. People in the wider community, you know, are still hurt by that. Because you particularly noticed it when police officer John Caldwell was shot earlier this year. A lot of people were suddenly became very nervous. Suddenly all of these memories floated back. And I think too, maybe particularly, almost for a lot of people, maybe where with a lot of, like, a while after I went and got myself counselling, but almost there were a lot of people who were in my type of situation. They weren't physically injured. Yes, they saw things or experienced the fallout. But people who felt that then that they had not suffered as much as the others, and they did not, of course, realise that psychological issues do come back at people. We're also talking now as well about the sheer trauma. Mm. For example, we can forget that people had to be taken to the then Tyrone County Hospital. You had, even for medical staff, it was difficult. But we're talking about, you know, portering staff, catering staff, cleaners. All of them witnessed things which they never imagined being in their job description. And there is that terrible trauma there as well. Some people in the emergency services, it took them a number of years, many years, to realise the trauma. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, too, many of the injured themselves, you know, physical injuries have maintained pain levels. And as people, quite a lot of people have got older, those pain levels have increased. There's maybe the terrible thing where a trauma centre was set up in OMA after the bomb, but it had to be closed a number of years ago because of lack of funding. There is both, obviously, locally, in the immediate OMA area, the fallout from the bomb. But tragically, we have traumatic events. Like, you know yourselves, I mean, the terrible explosion in Krishla. And that has obviously left a legacy in that community.
As you're speaking, I'm in my mind, it is hearing the news of the OMA bomb and how things unfolded. But obviously, you know, being very quickly on the scene in Krishla and being there over a number of days and getting an understanding of people's loss and grief and how the people are affected by it that weren't even there but had to deal with people that were. I really get a true understanding, and it's been referenced so many times that this felt like it was reminiscent of what the people of Oma and those caught up in it went through. Before I bring the next guest in, Anton, I'm going to come back to you back and forth if that's okay. How, once you arrived on the scene, was it instantly clear that the scale of it? I mean, obviously it was an awful scene for anyone to come upon or to be at, but was it instantly clear at that time that this was going to be, you know, multiple fatalities, hundreds injured? Was that obvious in the early moments on your arrival?
Probably no, because the horror was so terrible that it was overwhelming. Oh, you almost shut down under that. What a terrible experience like that.
Yeah, okay. Stay where you are, because we're also joined on the programme by Michael Gallagher, a gentleman who we've spoken to many times over the years because he's been a tireless campaigner. Michael Gallagher, his 21-year-old son Aidan, killed in the Oma bombing. Thanks for joining us, Michael. I hope you're okay. How are you keeping? How are you feeling at this time?
Good morning, Greg and Anton. I'm starting to sort of closed down, as it were. It's been hugely intense over the last fortnight. You know, I think Portobello must say that Anton described it very, very well, and it was truly, truly horrendous. You know, the bombers planted the bomb and ran away, and they left young policemen and young policewomen, shoppers, mainly teenagers, Noma, shop workers, to go in, just as Ant has described it, and you know, pick up things in your hand that would fall through your hands that nobody should ever have to experience in their life, and that trauma will be with all of those people. You couldn't be human if that didn't impact on you. Mm-hmm. It was truly shocking. And it's at times like this, you know, that you refocus, as it were. It never goes away. Mm-hmm. It's what I would say is the thinking time's dangerous, you know, before you go to sleep at night or when you're waking up in the morning, that you don't get out of bed. These things start to roll over in your head. You know, what could have been, what should have been. Mm. Aidan was 21. He's actually longer dead than he was alive. And that's, you know, it's quite difficult to sort of manage that in your head and understand it, because he was our only son. I have two girls. One was older and one was younger. And as a family, we felt that we could do anything when the family was there, because he had so much energy, and there's such a big gap in your life. But he is still a part of our family. We talk about him every day. You know, we changed the car last week, and we would say, I wonder what Aidan would think about this. That's not the case in all families. Yeah. Some, I know families that have never, ever mentioned their loved one. Mm-hmm. They couldn't, you know, it's just so painful. We all deal with grief.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very personal.
And Michael, obviously, the similarities between what happened, the awful tragedy in Chrysler and Oma, there are there. Obviously, the difference being this, what happened in Oma was a despicable, deliberate, indiscriminate, disgusting, inexplicable act, whilst what happened in Chrysler was not. But in talking to people afterwards, and some of the stories come from, it was the randomness of why people were taken, where they happened to be at a certain time for a particular reason. And then there's still people dealing with survivors' guilt that were there and just stepped away at a particular time. So there's so many people affected by this. And in Aidan's case, he just happened to be there.
He went in that day, but we had a small garage business. I'd done mechanical work and he hadn't done body work. And we had a car. We normally wouldn't work on a Saturday, but I had a car of my own. I was getting ready for the road test. And I went in the morning to the garage and I came back, I think maybe about 1 o'clock or after one. And I went into the kitchen and I said to my wife, Patsy, is Aidan up yet? Because I knew he was out with his friends the night before. And she says, oh, yes, he was up this morning out and paid some of his bills. He's just upstairs changing his clothes because he's going to go downtown with his friend.
Okay, that line dropped. Sorry, Michael, the line dropped briefly. Yeah. You were just talking about Aidan and his friends. It's not your fault. It's unfortunately a slight issue I have here. Yeah. But continue there, Michael. Sorry.
Yeah. And then a few minutes after that, Aidan came down. He just stood in the doorway. And we had a pleasant conversation. It doesn't always be when you have young people, you have a pleasant conversation. But we had a pleasant conversation. He was talking about his jeans, what size, because my wife normally buys them. And I said, don't worry about it. They'll put a tape on you when you go into the shop. And he just turned and walked down the hall. And I'll always remember, he looked back for the last time and he said, I won't be long. And that was the last time we seen Aidan. And he picked up Michael Barrett. They both went down. He bought a pair of boots, working boots, and a pair of jeans. Mm. And we didn't know at that time that Aidan wasn't the type. He wasn't the type of boy that would have said that he was going with a girder. But we knew that the reason he was buying them because he was going out that night to meet this girl. Mm. From there it was. I spent hours going back and forward. First of all, I went to the bomb scene, and I got as near as I could. And there was a young soldier there at that time, and he actually looked shell shocked. And he said, "You're better to go to the hospital." I went three times, and on the third time, I found Michael Barrett in a ward, and he was very badly burnt. And I asked him about Aidan. He said the last thing he remembers is just walking down the street, and then he ended up flying in the air. He doesn't know what he didn't know what happened. Aidan, he was then airlifted to the burns unit in Royal Victoria Hospital in Belfast. I was advised to go to the leisure centre. We spent hours at the leisure centre, and eventually about 2 o'clock in the morning, I was taken into a room and interviewed by a young policeman and policewoman, and I knew by the nature of the questions they were asking that there wasn't going to be a happy outcome. And then we had to go to the local army camp, was just nearby, and they had set up a temporary mortuary in order to give some privacy, because at that time the media was starting to arrive in the town en masse.
Okay, stay with us, Michael. I also want to bring in Lisa Dillon, who lost her 8-year-old brother, Oran Doherty, from Nacala Drive in Buncrana. Lisa, good morning to you. You were just 18 at the time. And again, Oran just happened to be in Oma on a school trip. What's your reflections of that day?
Good morning, Greg. Oran headed off with a positive mind and a wee neighbour, Sean McLaughlin, and another neighbour, Ronan McGrory, along with the Spanish students, on a wee trip which we thought was to the folk park, Ulster American Folk Park, and headed off as happy as Larry, most excited wee boys, and little did any of us know it was going to be around the corner from that moment on, you know. But I just remember how happy I was leaving the house that morning, because he actually came in to me, woke me up, because he was a bad traveller, and I was just home from Spain, and I had taken back a big bag of, like, know these hard coloured sweets. So he asked me for some of the sweets for travelling, so he took 2 for going and 2 for coming home, and unfortunately never got to take the 2 coming back. So that was my last memory of Oran, was going out the door that morning.
And then your dad had the impossible. Well, I mean, it's not impossible. He had to do it. He had the task of identifying him that following morning at 7 a.m. Again, unimaginable. How do you even put words on that? Just pure heartbreak.
Yeah, I mean, that must have been... Oh, I can't even imagine what I had to go through doing that. But yeah, it might have been just before 7 a.m. But yeah, we'll never forget that phone call. It was Dean McLaughlin seemed to get the phone call first, and we could just hear the pain coming from their front door. Mm. And then next thing, my auntie's phone rang because we all were gathered in her house. And it was my daddy to break the news that Orna passed away too. And I'll just never forget my mother's reaction. She just collapsed to the ground. And everybody around us, it was just a moment I'll never, ever forget.
And
just heartbreaking.
You perhaps heard of the bomb before you heard that news. Are you saying that at that time you'd have thought, well, Oren isn't there, so he's okay? I mean, was there uncertainty, or did you know at that point that he was in Omagh?
No, the minute I heard, I was on the main street in Buncrana, and a young fellow approached me. He would have been a relative of Ronan's, who was injured. Mm. And he said, did you hear there's a bomb in Omagh? The boys are there. And I thought, well, they're in the folk park, so I'm sure they're fine. I'm sure they're not near it. But just, you know, just get this feeling in your stomach, and I just couldn't get home quick enough. And as I got to Knockalla Drive and met my mother coming running towards me, just in such a panic, there's a bomb in Omagh. And I was like automatically trying to calm her down. It's okay, you know, I'm sure there's so many people there. The boys won't be in the town and blah, blah, blah. But you just had this feeling, and my mother especially had that feeling. She just knew in the pit of her stomach that this wasn't going to be a good outcome, you know. So, yeah, you kind of had that feeling it wasn't going to be good.
And is it still hard to make sense of it? Does it still feel real in that, you know, you say goodbye to someone and that's the last time you've seen them, that they're taken from you like this, Lisa? Is it difficult to process, and the manner in which Oren lost his life?
Yeah, absolutely. It really is. And I think as time goes by, I think about it more and I feel like it's a lot harder. Mm. If I sit and I actually think about it, it just would drive me crazy. It's so unfair that a child or that anybody would have to walk out their door and to think that maybe that's the last time you see them, and then such horrific circumstances. You know, the evilness behind it all, it's just so unfair. Yeah. And you think about it, I think about it all the time.
And we don't sort of want bereavement or loss to consume us, but neither would we want anger to consume us, because that, you know... But how have you dealt with that? Or did you feel anger? Have you anger? How do you deal with that side of your emotions?
You know, there's definitely anger when you sit and you think about it. You just could get so angry. Mm. It's just a simple fact that nobody has ever had to pay a price for that day. And I don't know how then people, if they're living to this day or what, how they live with themselves every day knowing what they did to all those people, the lives that they've affected forever. I really don't know how they live with themselves. You could get very angry, but you know, angry, but you have to just, you can't let it take control of you. You have to just be strong and try to forget about it. But
I know. And that's not healthy either, but sometimes you have to do what you have to do to survive. I want to let people know that there'll be a massive remembrance this evening in the Oratorium Buncrana at 6 p.m. And tomorrow, the day of the anniversary, there's a rosary on Knockalla Drive at 3 p.m. where the two boys lived. And both of these are open to the public, so the community can join in to remember and to stand with those affected by this as well. Lisa, thank you so much for your time, and sorry, so sorry for your loss and the family's loss, which is felt clearly by your comments today as strongly as it was on the day you learnt of this awful news. Thank you, Lisa.
No bother, Greg. Thank
you. Bye-bye. Take care. And I'll go back to Michael in a moment. Anton, just back to you, if that's okay. Anton McCabe. We've heard from Michael, and we'll hear more from Michael and Lisa and how this has impacted them. And you can multiply that into the hundreds of people who are scarred by 25 years on and can speak of it as if it were, you know, last week. Such a devastating impact on so many, many people.
Yes. I mean, that's it. Like, the trauma of this last, I mean, like, you know, what happened with Lisa, and as I said, you know, was just, I'd actually met her family shortly after the time. And it was terrible, like, what happened to Michael, which is something that no parent should have to bury a child as Michael had to, particularly in those circumstances. I mean, I think it means that we have to calmly say that what was done on Oma was a crime against humanity. Cannot be called anything else. Quarter of a century on, the trauma is there.
Mm.
People also, you know, people are dealing with things obviously in different ways. You know, Michael is seeing the ways in which his family can talk about it. There's people quarter of a century on, and we can understand how that doing that is still very, very difficult. And I'm sure it is difficult for Michael to do so in the circumstances. I think maybe too that the worst thing was that promises were made to relatives and to the community at the start. We had, they were told that no stone would be left unturned. It's now turned out, unfortunately, a lot of stones weren't disturbed. But even before we go to that, obviously, sometimes it will happen that police will be unable to gather sufficient evidence to get a prosecution. There were, I think, at the very least, the promises made were deeply irresponsible and have obviously, you know, as time has gone on, has increased the distress of relatives. Because I think obviously, you know, there would have been people for whom seeing convictions would have been central. Nobody, I think, and you could never have expected anybody to forgive those responsible. But then also, there are people who maybe, as lives go on, have to deal with it in other ways. But the central thing was when at the very start, great promises were made. But, Michael will remember those. Then when those promises were not fulfilled, sometimes even it is better to be honest with people and to at least say, look, we will do our best. It may be that our best is not good enough. But the difficulty for Michael and all the others is not that the best was not good enough, but it's rather that the best was not tried. And I think that does have a terrible effect on them. And of course, when we're discussing all of this, the central thing we have to remember is that it was the real IRA who planted the bomb. It is they who are ultimately responsible for the situation. It is they who ultimately set in process this whole horrible train of hurt that Michael and Lisa described so well this morning. And I think too, maybe particularly, I think with particularly some of the families would have had backgrounds in the security business. And there are people who therefore would maybe have been a trust there. And also maybe too that people whose families some of them I would know who served through the Troubles, would have felt that they were owed gratitude for having put themselves on the line over the years. And instead, the terrible thing is that all the relatives of Roma were betrayed by the promises made. That has certainly, that has deepened the hurt.
Yeah, okay. Anton McCabe, thank you so much for your time this morning. I really do appreciate it. Take care of yourself. Thank you, Anton.
Thank you.
We'll finish our conversation with you, Michael, I suppose, following on from those words, because, you know, a criminal conviction doesn't bring anyone back. The word closure is perhaps overused and overstated. But how has those broken promises, being misled, watching how the investigation unfolded or didn't, how it's the compounding of the grief, I suppose, and the loss, or maybe, Michael, you might phrase it as you think appropriate.
Well, we had two investigations, one on both sides of the border, and I remember the chief constable at the time, Tyrone Flanagan, saying that there was an excess of 20 people involved in this operation. And I remember the detectives, I can remember on the Sunday morning, the detectives at that time that were in charge of the investigation, and they came into my house and they assured me that the public, because of the utter devastation and outrage and the shock, as Antonis said, just four months after the Good Friday Agreement, you know, and people say we do phrase it in such a way that it was the worst atrocity of the Troubles, but the reality is it was the first atrocity of peacetime, and that was part of the shock that we felt. But I just always got the feeling that the detectives really wanted to solve this crime, but for whatever reason, their hands were tied behind their back, because all the information that should have been available to them, and we know this for certain, we know that MI5, GCHQ and RUC Special Branch didn't cooperate with the detectives in the way that they should have, and that's why I've campaigned for the public inquiry for over 20 years. And I'm on public record over that period of saying OMA was a preventable atrocity. And that's this new public inquiry that's been announced. I just feel that we have to get the terms of reference right. And it's not about reapportioning blame, because as Anton has put it, we know exactly who committed this crime because they took responsibility for it. But was there feelings? Could these people have been stopped long before the OMA bomb? Mm-hmm. There were 27 attacks in Northern Ireland from January to August. And 13 of those attacks is what the police describe as linked incidents. That means that the police believe that those 13, including OMA, were all carried out by the same people. Mm-hmm. They must have some kind of evidence, whether it's fingerprint, DNA, fibre evidence, electronic surveillance. There is a link there, and it just seems that it just died a death on both sides of the border, and that's why we need answers. We need to ask who done what and who did they talk to, and what was the outcome of that conversation. Mm-hmm. That's not the sort of questions that we have an opportunity to ask over the 25 years, but hopefully with the new inquiry we will. And again, I would appeal to anyone out there, no matter how little knowledge they have, if it just puts a little bit of the piece in the jigsaw, it would be hugely important when the inquiry starts to come forward.
Michael, thank you for your time today. I wish you all the strength that you need to get through the next couple of days and beyond. And over the last 25 years, through your loss and grief, you've been an amazing advocate for your beautiful son, Aidan, and the other victims in their hundreds of this atrocity. And we thank you over the years for all of your time, and still you continue to advocate and campaign. And you're just a remarkable human being, Michael. And we thank you so much for your time today at what must be a difficult time for you and the rest of those affected by this this atrocity.
Thank you, Greg.
Take care, Michael. Thank you very much indeed for that.
I remember sunny days and full showers of rain, staying out until it got dark. And I remember go-karts and bikes, darn knock-collar drivers, fly our way around the park. I remember gravel and knees, helicopters and trees, and two horses in my small back garden. I remember days spent fishing down by the river, clear nights spent staring at stars. I remember you. You were there when we felt defeated, though there were some hard times, but we never knew it. I still see the headlines and the picture of our friends in the paper. I'll never know why we got through, but the boys didn't make it. I will never forget that look of regret when your brothers didn't step off that bus. I remember going home with a fear of unknowing, a heartache so cruel and unjust. I remember long black cars and white wooden boxes, silence as they passed us by. I remember candlelit mass, putting my fingers in wax, and the echo of the family's cry.
And that's Paul Caldwell and his song there. He was friends with the young boys from Boncrana. He wrote the song last year, and that was called Headlines. I want to thank Elisa, Anton and Michael for helping us mark 25 years since that awful, awful tragedy. And you can hear from their voices, it's still there. Okay, we have to take a break as we say goodbye after these. Okay, very close to saying goodbye for this Monday morning. Just to remind you, Kevin Fury is around the Northwest after 12. He is in the hot seat for John Breslin. Takes three or four people to replace John. He must be incredibly important. But anyway, Kevin Fury gets his twist just after 12. So stay tuned for that, for the usual mix of fun and conversation and great music. A caller says, my God, the similarities to the stories of these people are so close between Chrysler and Omar. God love these people. They shouldn't have to go through this. No, they really shouldn't. Heartbreaking time for all the families who lost loved ones in that inhumane bombing. Would love to know the mindset of whoever authorised it, and why didn't our government do enough to try and find any of them? Thank you, Greg, for your empathy and compassion in Chrysler. I also met you doing your professional job, which you carried out with gentleness, care and tremendous compassion. Thank you. Thank you for that. It was very important at that time that it wasn't reporting on something, but actually just getting out information that was important to the community. You know, it wasn't a news story for me. It was a service that needed to be done. Okay, that's where we have to leave it on the programme. Thanks so much for listening. We're back with you tomorrow morning at 9. Thanks to Caroline and Niamh, of course. As I say, have a great Monday. Chat to you soon.